Council. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. We are hearing the next case, Red Star Group versus 1933 Lindale LLC via Zoom. I don't know if the attorneys have utilized this platform before. Our rules are the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellants and counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timekeeping mechanism displayed on the screen. Please be mindful of that so you don't go over the time allotted for your argument. Please also be mindful of any attempts by the judges to get your attention with a question. If necessary, we might raise our hand or simply try to interrupt you, but we found that these hearings are working quite well, and we hope you will find that to be the case today. We are ready for argument then. If appellant's attorney would introduce himself for the record, we'll hear your argument.
Good morning. My name is Jared Gorlitz, and I'm the counsel for the appellant, Red Star Group, LLC. Are we going to do all appearance, Your Honor, or are we just going to start with my argument?
Sorry, the hardest part about this is finding the unmute button. Just your appearance for now. Thank you, counsel.
Okay.
So you may proceed with your argument.
Oh, sorry. May it please the court, as I indicated, I'm counsel for the appellant. This case is about Red Star Group getting getting an appropriate opportunity to prove its legal claims in court. In essence, we're asking that the motion for summary judgment be reversed and that the injunction orders be remanded to the district court to address the excessive bonds that were issued by the court as part of those injunction bonds. This case, in a nutshell, it's a commercial purchase agreement, in essence, and it revolves around a dispute of the release of a mortgage. And it's not just some mortgage. It was a $2.3 million mortgage that Core Trust Bank had on this particular property. And there was a question as to whether my client was purchasing the property subject to that mortgage or that mortgage was going to be released as part of the sale of the property. And that's essentially what all these legal claims revolve around. My client did not close because he was worried about whether that mortgage was released. And essentially that led to the litigation and evictions and the motions and the decisions that lead us here today.
Now, Mr. Gorlitz, in terms of the legal theories that are still in play, I mean, this is the unjust enrichment claims are no longer part of this case. This is just a breach of contract case at this juncture, correct?
Correct.
All right. So and you agree that the relationship between the parties, the obligations of the parties are spelled out in the purchase agreement itself, correct?
Correct.
All right. Can you point me to the provision of the purchase agreement that the defendant was in breach of?
Well, the provision of the purchase agreement that they were in breach of was providing legal marketable title. The problem with that is that, and this is where you're going, and this is where the district court went. The argument that wasn't made, and the district court ultimately found, and now is argued here, is that my client, in essence, waived his right to object to this Core Trust mortgage. And basically, because he didn't object earlier under the terms of the purchase agreement, he, in essence, was buying this property with the Core Trust mortgage as an exception, meaning he was buying it subject to that mortgage.
That is what the purchase agreement provides, isn't it? I mean, if you're evaluating a breach of contract claim from the court's perspective, the first place you turn is to the contract, correct?
Maybe. And the reason I say maybe, and this is part of the problem with how I see some of these decisions being handled at the district court level. And then I come to the Court of Appeals and they're like, well, we can look at all the documents in the record as part of summary judgment. We can look at the contract. The issue starts before that, right? The court's not supposed to read the contract on its own and decide who's right and who's wrong and what arguments are made or should be made. And what defenses can be made. The court's supposed to take the arguments made by counsel and make a decision regarding those. So the court absolutely starts with the contract. Before it even gets to the contract, it starts with the arguments made by 1933 Lindale regarding whether It has or has not breached the contract. And here, 1933, Lindell did not say Red Star waived its argument regarding this particular issue. So we couldn't have breached anything because it waived its argument. That wasn't the argument made to the district court. The district court should have never been looking and reading the contract on its own and determining the issues it thought were appropriate in this case. That's not the American judicial model. The American judicial model is the court is to hear the arguments from counsel and decide those issues at the arguments made. And I could talk, I mean, at the Minnesota Supreme Court level, and I didn't put these in my brief, but also at the United States Supreme Court level, we are a judicial system where arguments are made by counsel and the court decides the arguments made by counsel. Otherwise, we might as well just give the contract to the court and the court can make its own decisions without any sort of arguments being made by counsel on one side or the other. The court would just make its determinations on its own. That's not the system we have. The system
Mr. Gerlitz, to be fair, I mean, as I read the summary judgment motion, and I think the respondent's attorney quoted from some of this language in the brief, I mean, there are specific references to 4.0 and 5.0 parts of the purchase agreement in the summary judgment motion. I don't know how I would get to a conclusion that those aspects of the purchase agreement weren't in front of the district court.
Well, and the reason it's not in front of the district court, well, first of all, right? And let's just be real. My client wasn't represented by counsel at this time. Ms. Schiller, who I know very well, said, well, he's not represented by counsel, hasn't responded to discovery. We're going to move for summary judgment. We didn't do anything wrong. In essence, they said we did not breach the contract. The specific issue that was not raised was this waiver argument. In fact, we had oral argument in front of Judge Robner, who I like very well and respect very well. But if she had made the same question that Your Honor just made to me and said, didn't your client waive this? I would then say, Your Honor, I don't think that issue's been briefed. We've not had the opportunity to address that. And we think we have defenses to that particular issue. But the question wasn't brought up at oral argument. The court has the transcript. The court essentially agreed or accepted that the defenses to the motion were something else. And that was that the defendants failed to set forth admissible evidence that this mortgage was actually going to be released. I would agree with you. There's references to the contract in the memorandum, but what's not in the memorandum is a statement of undisputed fact that my client did not object to the core trust mortgage as required under the purchase agreement.
Let me ask you, Mr. Gerlitz, about the district court's kind of second basic analysis, and that was is there evidence of other evidence of breach by the defendant? As I read provision 11.0, seller agrees that the deed conveying marketable fee simple title in the property to purchaser at closing. How could the defendant be in breach of this requirement when in fact the defendant showed up for closing and your client did not?
I think the issue would be anticipatory breach. And again, that wasn't raised at the district court level to me, either by the defendant or by the district court, so that we could flesh out an actual response to that.
But you didn't plead that in your complaint either, did you?
I didn't plead the complaint,
didn't plead that, did it?
My client's complaint did not plead that anticipatory breach, but that would be my argument. And had the district court raised that issue or the defendants had raised that issue, that would have been my response, that basically my client was anticipating a breach and it did not want to pay millions of dollars or $1.2 million to buy a property to find out it was subject to a $2.3 million mortgage. And now he's got a secondary fight regarding that issue. I guess put it back in anybody else's shoes in this room. Would you show up and pay $1.2 million if you were really worried about the title of the property? You wouldn't. You wouldn't close. And that's what my client did. Again, had these issues been raised at the district court level and my client been given a reasonable opportunity to address them, we would have made legal arguments. We didn't because it was never brought before us. We had a motion that basically said there's been no breach. And we said, you failed to establish there wasn't a breach. And, the reality is, I get everybody, that the court's going to say, well, Mr. Gorlitz, I don't know that your client's legal arguments are that strong. But the fact of the matter is that doesn't matter. We were never given the opportunity to make them in the first place. And that's the frustration I have with this decision and other decisions I've seen at the district court level, where judges basically say, well, I guess I can't rule on that argument, so I'm going to rule on this one, even though it hasn't been made by the parties. And that's unfortunately what I think Judge Robiner did here. In order for her to make the determination she made, it A, had to be raised by the defendant. And the other thing is the defendant had to establish there was an undisputed fact that my client did not dispute this exception. There is no undisputed fact in the record. And the reason there's no undisputed fact in the record is because that was not the basis for the defendant's motion. The basis for the defendant motion was purely on the element of breach, not on the element of, the condition precedent element, which all these arguments 100% relate to. And because of that, you know, the decision was issued sua sponte. The second, is there a timer? Oh, there it is. Got it. 5 minutes and 30 seconds. Got it. I'll move on to the excessive bond issue. I don't know that there's much to discuss regarding this. I don't know how anybody could look at this issue and say that a bond providing double security could not be considered excessive. And just to clarify, essentially the end result from the district court's decision regarding the bond was the defendants had two forms of security. They had the property, which wasn't going anywhere. The property still existed. This property still had the same value it always had. It's, say it's $1.2 million. And so the defendants always had that security in the event an injunction was issued stopping either the eviction or then subsequently stopping a cancellation of the purchase agreement. So the real damage under Rule 65.03, and the only damage, is the holding costs for this property while the injunction is pending, not the value of the property, because to my knowledge, nobody's argued that the property went away. So once the district court issues an order that you have to post bond for the value of the property, we now have double security. We have $1.2 million to secure the property, and we have the property itself. That's excessive. That's enormously excessive. And it was an error. I don't know that respondent or this court or anybody could justify that as a reasonable bond amount to cover the defendant's costs in the event a bond is the injunction is erroneously ordered and they've sustained damage. So the only damage, and this should have been the only amount for the bond, would have been the holding costs. Now, the simplest thing to cover the holding costs is rent. So the only bond amount that should have been ordered was the $13,000 of rent and not the value of the property. So on that basis, we believe the temporary injunction motions and the should be remanded to the court to resolve or address those motions when an appropriate bond has been awarded. I think it's clear in the decision from Judge Robiner the second time around, she certainly did address the Daubert factors. I can't dispute that because that's obvious on its face. That said, I don't think you can also dispute the fact that she was very annoyed. It shows up on oral argument as well. She was very annoyed and upset that my client hadn't posted the bond. And because my client hadn't posted the bond, it certainly impacted her decision. And it's only for her to decide whether an erroneous view of the bond, which my client should have not had to post it, changes her decision. And I think that's appropriate. And that's a reason to remand those orders back to her to decide whether and analyze the Daubert factors again once she has an appropriate view of the law and an appropriate view of the correct bond amount, which should only be the holding costs for this property while the motion for injunction is pending, or the injunction order is pending. So we're asking this court to reverse the motion for summary judgment because the order was issued sua sponte. No dispute, the court has the right to look at the documents before it and the contract and make a determination. But before the court makes those decisions, it actually has to make decisions on the arguments made by counsel. And the defendants did not argue that my client waived its right to request the release of this core trust mortgage.
But Mr. Gerlitz, your client, the respondent did argue that they were not in breach of the purchase agreement. And so given that that was the argument and given the evidence that respondents submitted, you know, that they tried to, you know, the day of closing, they continued to email and say, hey, we've got this partial release. Here's the unsigned thing from the mortgage company. And I mean, that they were acting as if they wanted to go forward with the closing. I mean, isn't at that point, doesn't your client in response have to come up with competent evidence to show breach?
No, the reality is, Your Honor, that my client, well, my client at some point has to establish breach, but my client didn't bring the motion. My client does not have the burden of proof at a motion for summary judgment. The burden of proof.
But counsel, to withstand a summary judgment motion, in fact, the opposing party does have to come up with competent evidence, does it not?
No.
To show that there's
not until
a genuine issue for trial?
Not until the burden changes. The burden only changes to the non-moving party once the moving party has established its burden, either A, that it's entitled to judgment as a matter of law, or B, that there are no issues of material fact in dispute. Here, the plaintiff or the defendants failed to establish there were no reasonable facts not in dispute, because we established that the one fact they relied upon, and that was that they were going to release this mortgage as part of the closing, was not properly before the court. They had no admissible evidence at the time of summary judgment that they could actually release that mortgage. All they had was hearsay and other evidence that didn't satisfy the evidentiary rules, which we all argued and set forth at our motion for summary judgment. So had they set forth, Your Honor, admissible evidence, then the burden would have transferred to my client. And I would 100% agree with you that we can't sit back on our hands and do nothing. But the argument that was made and the argument I'm making to Your Honor is they did not meet their burden of proof, so it did not switch to us. And that's why the motion for summary judgment should have been denied. And I think Judge Robner agreed with us, which is why she came at the decision this way. I see my time's up, so I will respond in rebuttal.
Counsel for respondent, would you please introduce yourself for the record and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. Rebecca Schiller appearing on behalf of 1933 Lindell LLC, the respondent in this appeal. Unless the court has an objection, I'll just follow the same track that Mr. Gerlitz did by addressing the summary judgment order first and then going into the two motions, the two orders regarding the injunctive relief. I'll refer to Red Star and my client as Lindell. That's easiest, as the briefing did. It's common for attorneys to claim that a case is straightforward and simple, but in this case, that actually is the truth. In this appeal, we have one issue, and in fact, Red Star acknowledged that there was only one issue in its opposition memorandum at summary judgment stage. The quote was, the sole issue in this case is whether 1933 Lindale could, in fact, and supported by admissible evidence in the case, obtain a release of the mortgage from Fortress Bank. So at the time that my client's summary judgment motion was filed, there were several affidavits already in the record due to the previous motions. So the two key affidavits were the affidavit of Mitch Chargo, who was the attorney formerly with my firm who represented Lindale in the purchase agreement negotiations. Then there also is an affidavit from Brett Fisher, who was a commercial closer with Commercial Partners Title. And those, if you want to reference to the index, the court wants to reference, it's document 11 is Ms. Chargo's affidavit, and document 12 is Brett Fisher's affidavit. So the relevant, with regard to that sole issue that Red Star identified in this opposition memorandum, there was two key exhibits and key testimony from Mr. Fisher. That was the unexecuted copy of the partial release that was drafted by Cortrex Mortgage, and that was provided to Red Star. That was attached as Exhibit 8 of Mitch Chargo's affidavit. There was also the revised Exhibit 8, the limited warranty deed, which removed any reference to the Cortrex Mortgage. Brett Fisher and the court specifically cited this, this language in the order, said, I would have proceeded to close the transaction even if I did not have the original partial release in my possession, because the pay down letter confirmed that Core Trust would provide the partial release. Lenders regularly provide the release or satisfaction documents only after payment or pay down of the loan. Mr. Fisher also stated that after closing, Commercial Partners would have been in a position to issue owner's title policy without exception. So my initial memorandum, there's been a lot of talk about what I didn't bring up. And as I referenced in my brief, there was a specific paragraph in my memorandum on page 8 where it discusses paragraph 5 of the purchase agreement. And it talks about that when the commitment was provided to Red Star, it talks about they never objected to it. Specifically, Red Star had 7 days after receipt of the title commitment to raise objections. Lindale would then have 10 days to attempt to cure the objections. If Red Star had timely complied with the procedure set forth in the purchase agreement regarding objections to title, there would have been an opportunity for the parties to resolve the issues prior to the date of closing. While I may not have argued that that was a waiver, I certainly had the issue squarely in front of the court at the time of the summary judgment motion that this was an issue, and this is one of the reasons why my client did not breach the purchase agreement. As Judge Bjorken already pointed out, that was the whole point of it, to show that my client did not breach the contract. This whole idea of condition precedent, which is throughout Red Star submissions, is simply something they raised on appeal to basically reframe the issue for the court, which doesn't need to be reframed. With regard to the summary judgment motion, the tactic was, as the court already referenced, doesn't Red Star have to provide some evidence in opposition to the summary judgment motion? Yes, the case law is very clear. They have to provide some type of response and some evidence. But what they did instead was simply argue that my client's evidence was not admissible. So in response to that argument, I provided two additional affidavits. For my client, Charlie Theros, who's the secretary and treasurer of Lindale, and my affidavit that had the seller's closing statement, the pay down letter from Cork Trust, and emails between Cork Trust counsel and Mitch Chargo, Lindale's counsel. So those documents directly refuted, again, whether Lindale could obtain a release of the mortgage from Cork Trust Bank. The only issue that Red Star acknowledged was the only thing left in the case. So then Red Star's response, of course, was to strike those documents, but the court denied that motion. So both in the written submissions and the arguments, Red Star never provided any evidence of breach or addressed the merits of Lindale's arguments. It just sought to exclude admissible evidence that clearly demonstrated my client was prepared to move forward and have the mortgage release and move forward with the closing. So on appeal, now we have Red Star using a slightly different procedural tactic, but it similarly relieves them of the responsibility of addressing the merits. Once again, the brief is all about sua sponte. I was not able to address these issues. That's the whole focus of the brief with regard to the summary judgment motion. And as I've already mentioned, it was argued in my brief, the brief also analyzed every paragraph of the purchase agreement that discussed the seller's obligations at length. The fact that the court chose to focus on the one issue as far as the objection to title, that is the court's discretion to do so. There hasn't been no case law cited by Red Star that the court is not allowed to do that. It was before the court. The court didn't make the arguments for me. The court chose to focus on that particular issue. I would also note that.
But shouldn't a court, I mean, part of the way our system works is for the court to provide some opportunity to the litigants to address an issue that's important to the court. And I appreciate that you reference 501 or 4.0 and 5.0 in your summary judgment motion, but it seems that you didn't exactly make the argument that the district court latched onto in terms of a condition precedent. I mean, isn't a party opposing summary judgment entitled to be able to address such a fundamental legal issue that is not, at least in my mind, squarely presented in the moving parties documents?
I would agree with that statement. However, again, Red Star didn't address any of my arguments, whether that's an argument or not. But I would also point out, more importantly, Red Star's position is based on the trial court, not that being the sole basis for the trial court's decision to grant summary judgment, and that's not the case. There were several bases. If you look back on section 2C of the order for summary judgment, the court says, even if the Cork Trust mortgage were timely objected to by Red Star, the breach of contract claim fails because Lindale was not required to have the mortgage released until the closing. They didn't have to provide anything before the closing. The court also analyzed Lindale's obligations regarding the limited warranty deed, the poor trust mortgage payment down letter and the partial release. That was all included in the order. It was not the sole basis. The basis for the decision was that Lindale didn't, or I'm sorry, Red Star never came back with any evidence of breach. That was the actual ruling in the case. Yes, the court did focus on the timely objection, but that was before the court already in my moving papers. I would, again, if it wasn't argued, I didn't use the term waiver, I didn't use the condition, term condition precedent, nor did the court, but the analysis was there, both in my moving papers and in the court's analysis. I'd like to just turn to the reply memorandum for a brief moment because I haven't had the opportunity, obviously, to address that. With regard to this argument that the fact that Red Star did not object to the title needed to be in the undisputed facts section, there was 25 material facts that I referenced, and one of them is that when the title commitment was provided to Red Star, and that was in paragraph 8. And then again, I did address it in the argument section that they didn't timely object to the title. So there's no case law to my knowledge or any procedural rule that requires that particular issue to be in the undisputed facts for the court to rule upon it. One of the other arguments is that my client didn't follow the proper procedure because the court didn't analyze the same provisions of the purchase agreement as the trial court. That's not true. I analyzed all the provisions of the purchase agreement that pertain to the seller's obligations, including section 5, which the court focused on. And again, I already talked about that wasn't the sole basis for the court's decision. And again, one of the arguments is that the contract, breach of contract elements were not set forth in the court's order or in my briefs. The court simply chose to cite a different case for basic contract law. But the court choosing not to cite the case that Red Star wants the court to cite, Park Nicollet Clinic versus Hammon, does not create a sua sponte situation here. Finally, you know, the argument that my client only sought summary judgment on the breach element, that's all I had to prove. We all acknowledge there was a contract here. That's in the court's order, that statement. We all acknowledge there was a purchase agreement here. So we didn't have to argue anything except the breach. You know, the condition precedent was argued within the context of the corresponding obligations between the parties. One triggered the other obligation. So again, Red Star itself limited the issues that were before the court in the summary judgment motion by its opposition memorandum. And the court fully addressed those issues. And this was simply not a sua sponte decision. Quickly, with regard to the excessive bond, as I mentioned in my brief, none of these arguments about double security or what the proper bond amount were, they were never argued in the submissions previously or the arguments. And with regard to, if you follow that reasoning, that it has to be the loss in value and you go to look at the rent and it can't be the entire purchase, how is the trial court supposed to determine the loss of value when the case could be pending for a year or two? How is the court supposed to determine what the current market value would be in 2 years? This is precisely
my concern, Ms. Schiller. My concern about the bond, among a couple of concerns, is how do we even know how the district court exercised its discretion? Because the first TRO order doesn't go through the Dahlberg factors. It provides no explanation as to how we get to both a rental, you know, he's got to pay the rent every month. And I understand that would be to stay the eviction, which was a separate action. But then this $1.2 million bond, again, with no explanation. I mean, how can we even review that? Don't we have to remand the question of the injunction and the bond, given that fact?
No, Your Honor, and this is why. The court very specifically stated on the record that she was going to do a two-part. She wanted to get the order out quickly because she knew there was an eviction pending. So what happened was that she said, I'm going to rule, and she very clearly, if you read the transcript, she said she told the parties where she was going, how she was going to rule. And the trial court said, look, I'm going to do a preliminary, and then I'm going to follow up the Dahlberg factors. But since the bond was never posted, she didn't issue a secondary order. So she was granting the motion. She wasn't denying it. My client, I guess, could have objected to the Dahlberg analysis not happening in the order, but you know, that wasn't a problem for us. So for me, the issue became one, the reason that the bond was set at that amount, in my opinion, is the court was analyzing two relationships between the parties, a landlord-tenant relationship and the relationship of a buyer and a seller. by allowing the Red Star to stay in the property during the pendency of the action, my client can't sell the property. They can't do anything with the property. They have to, so they're losing their right to have income from the sale as well as rental income. So I do want to point out, and this was in my brief, this transcript from the hearing, Red Star's position at the hearing was that the quote was, the client was still wanted to buy the property. That's what the judge's decision was based on. If that was the case, that they still wanted to buy the property, $1.2 million was the purchase price and $1.2 million was the bond. That's where, you know, I can't look into the trial court's decision except that her reasoning was already on the record, I think. And again, I argued that they basically admitted to or acceded to having this bond, but, you know, I wouldn't go that far, but it does appear that they were agreeable to it. With regard to the order denying the temporary restraining order, in that respect to that one, again, there weren't a lot of arguments from Red Star on this issue. I would simply point out that the Daubert factors, as Mr. Gorelitz acknowledged, were clearly discussed in the case. Very clear analysis. It was not simply a decision based on the fact that Red Star did not post the bond. Yes, the court does address that, but it also addresses all the issues with regard to, you know, likelihood of success on the merits, the balancing of harms. It was not the only basis for the decision. Lastly, I just want to address this law of the case issue that was brought in a reply memorandum. Law of the case is a doctrine that usually applies to appellate courts, a legal issue where it's remanded to the lower court. This doctrine usually isn't applied to trial court decisions. And again, it wasn't the only basis for the case, for the decision by the trial court. Also, when you're determining a bond, it's not really a rule of law. I would argue that it would be more of a fact-based decision based on, you know, the property right involved or the relief that was sought. So we are requesting that the court affirm all three orders. I'll conclude with that, unless you have any additional questions.
Seeing none, counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court again. Obviously, for the record, counsel for the appellant Red Star. Just initially here, I will agree with Ms. Schiller that the issues on summary judgment were extremely straightforward in the record, and that's clarified by the oral argument that we did limit the issue to the court, and my client acknowledged this, that we limit the issue to whether this mortgage was in fact going to be released as part of the closing or not, and whether the defendant had submitted admissible evidence to that fact.
When you say, I just want to make sure that I really understand that argument. When you say that was the only issue, I mean, the overall issue was there a dispute of fact, or was respondent entitled to summary judgment because there's no breach? Right? No evidence of breach as a matter of law. But when you say the issue was, I think what you were saying is that your objection to dismissing the breach of contract claim was that you believed there were disputed facts on this, whether they were going to be able to release this core trust mortgage. Is that correct? Okay, good. Thank
that's
you.
Correct. That was our position. The I guess minor point that I wanted to make is, and this technically isn't before this court because the district court didn't address the arguments made, at least on the oral record, for summary judgment. It did strike down my motion, or it did deny my motion to strike the affidavits submitted as part of the reply, which were an attempt to admit additional evidence after our time to respond to the motion, which is kind of gets at the heart of the issue, which we believe is those are the issues that would be in dispute between the parties, and those would be the issues that would be discoverable by the plaintiff to resolve this pretty narrow issue regarding the closing. To the extent the court's looking at those at all, I do think it's improper for a party to submit evidence as part of a reply that supports their initial burden of proof for a motion. When they file a motion for summary judgment, they need to set forth the standard, which is we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, and there are no issues of material fact in dispute. Be improper for a party to fail in its initial burden as part of its moving papers, the defendant call it out in opposition. And then the moving party again in the reply say, oh yeah, you're right. We didn't meet our burden initially when we moved for summary judgment, but now we did in reply. That avoids again the entire aspect of our judicial system that you get to address the issues in front of you. And that's why, you know, the responding party gets an obligation. It has the ability to respond to those issues. It would be improper for somebody to bring those up on reply. And I know the court deals with those as well when people raise issues in a reply and on appeal as well. As far as the district court making other determinations that my client's claim failed, I think we've addressed some of those. But again, I would say mostly the court relied upon this inadmissible evidence, and kind of skirted around it when it tried to find a secondary reason to dispose of our motion, talking about the limited warranty deed and this pay down letter and this partial release. Again, the simple fact is there was no admissible evidence brought before the court on the motion for summary judgment that this mortgage was in fact and undisputedly going to be released. They simply submitted either inadmissible hearsay evidence or evidence that failed to follow the best evidence rule, which we're arguing in our papers. So there was not admissible evidence at the time of summary judgment to support the defendant's theory that they had not breached. And that was the basis by which we objected to the motion. And that's the basis by which we think this case should be remanded on summary judgment for us to put those issues before the court. I don't have anything really to add on the excessive bond issue. I'll rely on my arguments earlier. My only point will be if a party is paying the holding costs, which are in essence rent, then I think that provides appropriate security for the party being enjoined. Secondarily, if there is an argument that there's some decrease in value that could happen over a period of time, the responding party could argue that to the district court and say, hey, you know, we're going to be additionally damaged beyond the holding costs. And that was never analyzed by the court. And my time's up. So I'd ask the court to reverse the district court's decision on summary judgment and remand the two injunction orders back to the district court for consideration with respect to the excessive bond. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments, counsel. The matter is submitted. You'll have a decision within 90 days as required by law.